Intellectuals, doctors, teachers, lawyers, and clergy are also part of their societies. They too participate in the hateful discourses, in which they are no less and often more embedded than the community's other members who create and sustain them. They too act or support the acts that follow on their logic. No significant part of the German elites thought the Jews wholly innocent and therefore dissented from the fundamentals of the eliminationist project against the Jews, though some would have preferred a non-lethal eliminationist solution. Even the leading German resistance groups to Hitler were profoundly anti-Semitic, which informed their future plans for Jews. One of the resistance's central documents, prepared by leading Protestant theologians and university professors, contained an appendix called Proposals for a Solution to the Jewish Problem in Germany, which, referring to Jews, stated that a post-Nazi Germany would be justified in taking steps to ward off the calamitous influence of one race on the national community. Yet, thanks to the highly effective exterminationist program, they could perhaps tolerate Jews in Germany because the number of Jews surviving and returning to Germany will not be so large that they could still be regarded as a danger to the German nation. German elites were active, willing, and leading participants in the annihilationist assault on the Jews and in the Germans' other eliminationist projects. Einsatzgruppen leaders slaughtering Jews in the Soviet Union were academically trained, as were the principal author and others working on the murderous and eliminationist anti-Slav general plan for the East. Church leaders and clergy the world over, from Turkey to Germany to Croatia to Indonesia to Serbia to Rwanda, and to the political Islamic religious leaders and clerics in different countries, have actively and tacitly blessed mass murder. Where, we should ask, have religious leaders opposed their countrymen's or clansmen's eliminationist assaults? If they had, such as the Bulgarian Orthodox Church leaders who were instrumental in preventing the Bulgarian Jews' deportation, or Pastor André Trocmé, who led an effort in Le Chambon-sur-Linon in France that saved 5,000 Jews, we would know and they would have prevented countless deaths. Yet we know of so few. Local dignitaries often organized and led the Bosnian Serbs' paramilitary or local killing institutions. In Rwanda, the local intellectuals were in the thick of the mass murder. Jean-Baptiste Munyankore, a Tutsi teacher and survivor, explains, "The principal and the inspector of schools in my district participated in the killings with nail-studded clubs. A priest, the burgomaster, the sub-prefect, a doctor, they all killed with their own hands. These well-educated people were calm, and they rolled up their sleeves to get a good grip on their machetes." Well-educated people, leading professionals of one society after the next, together with those looking up to them, have closed ranks in a community of murderous consent. After eliminationist assaults, after the massive death toll and the vast suffering the perpetrators have inflicted become clear, in country after country, in town after town, the perpetrators return to their people, whose names they have blackened in the world's eyes, but evidently not in their own. In every mass murder and elimination's aftermath, the broader community in whose name the perpetrators acted has not socially or politically rejected, let alone punished, the perpetrators. Punishment has occasionally been meted out by those defeating perpetrators or replacing the perpetrating regime. The perpetrators have not been turned into outcasts, nor shunned, nor treated in any way as a community would ordinarily treat murderers, let alone mass murderers, in their midst. It did not happen in Turkey, in Germany, in Indonesia, in Serbia, or among Serbs in Bosnia, who after the eliminationist assault continued to celebrate the Bosnian-Serbian eliminationist architects Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic as heroes, in Burundi, in Rwanda, among the Hutus themselves. Communities welcome the perpetrators back, and when necessary and feasible, have passionately risen to defend them. The social and communal solidarity the perpetrators find in the post-eliminationist era merely continues the solidarity they experienced while assaulting their victims. We do not know the percentage of each community's people who have supported the exterminationist and eliminationist politics perpetrators practiced in their name. Everywhere, among Turks, among Serbs, among Hutu, there has been some communal dissent. Even in Germany, where the evidence of broad and deep popular support for the eliminationist assault against the Jews is overwhelming, some dissent existed. The ready knowledge we have of it, and often by the dissenters' own admission of their isolation, further confirms Germans' overwhelming support for the elimination. Nevertheless, in our time's lethal and non-lethal eliminationist assaults, we find among the broader relevant national or ethnic communities little credible evidence of widespread dissent from the eliminationist conceptions of the victims and the thinking underlying such politics, or of actual opposition to the eliminationist onslaughts themselves. But we have abundant evidence of active communal support and encouragement for the perpetrators, of the perpetrators' comfort within their various communities and among their countrymen, and of the perpetrators' smooth reintegration into their accepting communities when the mass killings, expulsions, and incarcerations end. Camp Worlds. One kind of community deserves special attention as it is prominent among the things making our age politically distinctive. Camps, usually called concentration camps, or more precisely, camp systems. They are typically worlds unto themselves. The camp system, distinct from yet intermeshing with society's other systems, is a novel feature of eliminationist politics, differing from, though related to, earlier slave camps used to extract labor, and its creation critically demarcates one type of eliminationist onslaught from all others. Spatially fixed and temporally durable, a camp system usually marks mass murder and elimination as integral to a country's social and political system. Its creation derives more from its leaders' general conception of politics and the society they wish to govern or forge than from the specific conception of the victims, aside from the foundational belief that the victims must be violently eliminated. Blame for inventing modern camp systems belongs to the Spaniards, who emptied a good portion of Cuba for concentration into camps in 1896 to defeat rebellion. The Spaniards kept the camps in deplorable conditions so that perhaps 200,000 people, mainly women and children, perished. In South Africa in the 20th century's first years, the British, likely inspired by the Spaniards, incarcerated more than 100,000 Boer women and children and blacks rebelling against them in a camp system, taking more than 40,000 people's lives, with each group's minimum toll at 20,000. The British, wishing to secure their colonial rule against insurgencies, used camps elsewhere. In Malaysia, they sought to quash the communist and nationalist insurgency with a declared emergency in 1948, lasting years, and a detention camp system incarcerating 30,000 people, from which they expelled more than half to China. This turned out to be a strategic pilot program the British implemented full force in the 1950s in Kenya. After losing India, the empire's crown jewel, in 1949, they were desperate to hold on to Kenya when, in 1952, the Mau Mau liberation movement challenged their draconian rule. Given that Mau Mau enjoyed the allegiance of most Kikuyu, whom the 50,000 British settlers had been systematically dispossessing of their land, the British, in order to secure their colonial position, decided to eliminate Mau Mau and its bearers, which meant eliminating the Kikuyu population as effective claimants to their own land and to self-determination. They created an extensive and murderous camp system, so murderous that the common view was that their purpose was to kill Kikuyu, as they starved them, refused to let them farm their lands, and denied them medical treatment. This system was internally differentiated with several categories of camps, the British assigning individual Kikuyu to camps of varying severity designed to incarcerate, break, warehouse, or kill them. The British incarcerated perhaps 1.5 million Kikuyu, a good portion of the people, and killed tens of thousands. Estimates range from 50,000 to 300,000. The British demonized the Kikuyu as Mau Mau cannibals, a wholly invented charge. This was layered upon a profound racism that held black Africans to be mentally and morally inferior, mixed with fear of Mau Mau insurgents who attacked and killed, initially, a few British settlers. Soon after the Mau Mau's attacks began, the British, with both colonial administrators and settlers often forming the shock troops of the grinding onslaught, quickly created the Pipeline, an array of more than 100 formal camps meant to be a system of holding pens and re-educative institutions, further augmented by scores of unofficial private settler camps and other camps into which they drove perhaps a 500,000 Kikuyu. The British then restricted most Kikuyu, more than 1 million deemed less threatening, to thoroughly inadequate tribal reserves, which, consisting literally of barbed wire villages, were camps, or in John Nottingham's formulation, concentration camp villages, except in name. As the British changed individual victims' status, they imprisoned and shuttled them around the gulag of increasingly harsh concentration camps. The Pipeline itself quickly worsened, as re-educative camps do, because of the inherent contradictions of such camps, which, whatever their formal purpose, incarcerate people the perpetrators believe must be eliminated. Josiah Mwangi Kariuki, a longtime British camp inmate, explains that as the British had set for themselves the impossible eliminationist task of eradicating the Mau Mau from the Kikuyu by getting Kikuyu to confess and recant, the camps devolved into something more horrible. The Pipeline system in its original conception did not involve beating or hitting in any way. But because it was basically unsound, it began to go slower and slower, and it was at this stage that the government officers employed the violence that in the end destroyed the use of confession as the foundation of the Pipeline. Few people anywhere feel bound by words uttered under torture. Beyond this feature of the Pipeline, the British colonial officials and settlers subjected the Kikuyu herded into camps to severe undernourishment, brutality, torture, and murder. Fueled by racism, a hallucinatory image of the Kikuyu as bloodthirsty savages, and the seemingly limitless justifying emotion of revenge, British perpetrators conducted themselves with cruelty reminiscent of the Germans' treatment of Jews and others. Paul Mahihu, a Kikuyu survivor, explains that as he was watching a film about the Germans' treatment of Jews in camps, he was thinking that that was what the British had done to his people. The politics engendering camp systems are typically long-term imperial domination or the visionary transformation of a country's social and political structure and fabric. For the Germans, the two went hand in hand. Such projects necessitate the violent domination or elimination of targeted, unwanted, or putatively recalcitrant groups, sometimes numbering tens of millions. The Germans, Soviets, Chinese Communists, Khmer Rouge, and North Korean Communists sought to transform society into subjectively ideal realms, purified by purging all they deemed inimical and unwholesome, albeit according to enormously different visions, which necessitated the elimination of millions or tens of millions of people for whom they erected camps as the permanent instrument of a combination of domination, exploitation, and annihilation. The Japanese, like the British in Kenya, followed no such eschatological transformative vision. They erected their vast camp system for merciless domination and exploitation. Such political goals, which visionary transformative regimes often share, are incompatible with the quick and final kill, leading political leaders to create camp systems and their followers to staff them sympathetically. The Japanese sought to occupy East Asia as a gigantic empire to serve their master race, enslaving tens of millions as disposable minions to be worked brutally, including to death, to extract the natural resources and produce the materials necessary for Japan to expand and maintain its Orwellian-named co-prosperity sphere. The Germans sought to transform the European landmass, particularly in Germany and to the east, into a vast racialized latifundium that German overlords would settle, and enslaved putative subhumans would work to sustain while being pruned and kept in check through reproduction prevention and steady killing. Already in the fall of 1940, Hans Frank, the German governor of Poland, clearly outlined this vision of Europe while speaking specifically of Poland. "We think here in imperial terms, in the most grandiose style of all times. The imperialism that we develop is incomparable with those miserable attempts that previous weak German governments have undertaken in Africa." Frank reported to his audience that the Führer has further said explicitly that Poland is, in Frank's paraphrase, destined to be a gigantic work camp where everything that means power and independence is in the hands of the Germans. No Pole would receive higher education, and none may rise to a rank higher than foreman. In Hitler and Frank's view, the Polish state would never be restored. The Poles would be permanently subjugated to the master race. Frank's elaboration upon this vision of the concentration camp as the model for Poland was not secret, but expressed in two speeches to his administration's department heads as the governing ethos to the people governing Poland. Hitler's and his political blueprint is what the Germans were actually implementing in Poland and elsewhere east of Germany. As Himmler, the principal operational architect of the Germans' eliminationist policies and practices, is reported to have communicated to one of the SS and police forces leaders in charge of an occupied area of the Soviet Union, "The Ukrainians should become a people of helots that work only for us." As tools in their eliminationist politics, the Germans erected 20,000 camps, mainly in Germany and conquered eastern territories, the formal extermination camps for Jews being the most infamous. Some Germans' allied and puppet regimes set up parallel camps, most notably the Croats camps, where they victimized and slaughtered Serbs, Jews, Sintis, and Romas. The Germans established camps in 1933, and once established, particularly with the military conquests after 1939, the system expanded easily and, according to the Nazis' logic, naturally. It became a permanent system of German society and of the Germans' empire of suffering and exploitation they were creating in Europe. It was the theoretical and de facto model for much of Europe, not just Poland, that the Germans were creating. A demythologized Waffen-SS man, Otto Ernst Duschelite, who saw firsthand his countrymen's transformation in the East, when asked what the world would have looked like had they won the war, explains, "It would have been terrible. I am not capable of imagining how bad this would have been. Hitler wanted not only Germany, he wanted to defeat the whole world, and everything would have been transformed into a huge concentration camp." The Germans' camp world contained many gradations depending on the principal incarcerated group's racial, political, and sexual definition, the camp's formal functions, and their staffs. In all cases, the camps were integrated into their region's politics, society, and economy. In Eastern Europe, they were the foundation of German politics. In Germany itself, camps fully integrated into the German economy and society were an unavoidable part of the urban and rural landscape. In them, the Germans incarcerated an ever-growing slave population, mainly of Slavic people. In the small state of Hesse, at least 606 camps, one for every 5-by-7-mile area, apocalyptically shaped the physical and social landscape. Berlin, the country's capital and showpiece, housed 645 camps just for slave laborers. It would be interesting to ascertain how small the mean physical distance was between Germans and a camp, how many camps each German on average encountered during a week, and how little removed the most distant spot in Germany was from a camp. The Soviets' gulag was a sprawling camp world of more than 470 individual camp systems, each having hundreds or thousands of individual camps. The Soviets used this vast eliminationist infrastructure to help govern their empire of domination and communist fantasy and transformation, consuming millions of real, designated, and fantasized enemies. Like the German camp system, the Gulag was a multifunctional, lethal, exploitative, and penal system where the Soviets warehoused, enslaved, and killed their designated enemies. Kolyma, the most infamous Soviet camp complex in the Arctic's frozen tundra, rivaled the most lethal German camps in overall murderousness, though not in annual death toll, consuming from 1937 to 1953 hundreds of thousands of lives. Like the Germans' camp world, the Soviets' camps, starting small and easily expanding into the vast Gulag archipelago, were employed to house and coordinate a slave population, with perhaps 18 million people passing through them, which the Soviets, as in Kolyma, often used as production factors, often working them quickly or slowly to death. Galician Kalinikovich, imprisoned for 15 years in the Gulag, began working in the Kalamar mines early in his imprisonment in October 1938, when the Gulag was at its worst. He describes how the prisoners worked and died in the Arctic Siberian wasteland from inhuman conditions, from hunger. It was 70 degrees below. They worked 12 hours a day. The barracks were freezing cold, and people perished in these conditions. Sometimes you'd walk to work, and on the way people would freeze to death, there, who couldn't make it to the camp. That's the kind of conditions they had. It was before the war. By 1941 it got a little better, and in 1941 the war started, the workday became 16 hours. Imagine working 16 hours in the freezing cold, rain, snow, no matter, we worked. Of 1,500 in his group, 450, about one-third, died within the first 3 months, which Kalinikovich says was a quite usual death rate for the various Kalamar camps. Whatever the Soviet Gulag's formal and sometimes substantive similarities to the Germans' camp world, the differences were profound and fundamental, so much so that equating them is a mistake. Uknalyev Ilyich, when wanting to convey the character of work in the Arctic Vorkuta camps during his imprisonment starting in 1948, spontaneously, without any prompting, brought up the German camps. "You see," he explains, "it wasn't the same kind of camps as the German concentration camps. People who had been arrested and brought there, to the Gulag, were there in order to work and not for extermination. In other words, the goal to annihilate wasn't there." The sprawling Gulag was an enormously variable system, which the German camps were not for Jews, and were much less so even for other prisoner groups. The Gulag's camps had widely varying death rates and conditions and treatment of its prisoners, which depended on the camps' locations, their work, and the orientation of individual camps' commanders and staffs. Although camp staff often treated political prisoners and criminals differently, regularly pitting the two groups against each other, a hierarchy of treatment and cruelty toward different victim groups, akin to the Germans, discussed momentarily, did not exist. The Gulag's character also changed enormously over time, including in the treatment of prisoners, in a manner the German camp world did not once it expanded into its mature form. The German camps existed more briefly, but because they used them to execute well-articulated and long-term eliminationist plans, mainly to destroy or eliminate people considered demons or subhumans, it is hard to see how that camp world would have been tempered significantly. The Gulag was its most brutal and lethal in the late 1930s, and by the late 1940s, owing to various causes, including a relaxation from the top, had become, though still an abominable if not hellish place, far less deadly and punitive toward its denizens. Kalinikovich freely describes the Gulag's inhumanity and enormous death rates during its worst years, including especially in the Arctic Kolyma camp, Burlag. The situation there was 1,000 times worse than usually in a camp. First of all, they were taken to work shackled, that's one. Second, once they finished their work, they'd be locked up, and the guards put a bucket there. And you can imagine, you say, why people died. People got emaciated very quickly. Kalinikovich also conveys the Gulag's changes and how it differed fundamentally from the German camps. There were parcels, they were allowed, letters were allowed, but everything was checked, so, well, I, of course, sent letters via the free people, those in Kolyma who were not prisoners. I had friends among the free people, and I would send my wife money, and prior to being released, I had already an outfit, the clothes my wife had sent me. I had everything in Kolyma. That was doable. I have to say that towards the end, in the years beginning after the war, the regime softened. There was less tyranny. Before, we were the prisoner swine, and besides, we were the enemy of the people. That put a certain imprint on us as well as the way the free people dealt with us. But during this whole time, during the wartime, the free people understood what kind of enemy of the people we were. And that's why, during my stay in Kolyma, 15 years, the view was turned upside down. The Gulag, unlike the Nazi camps, allowed cultural lives for the prisoners, including orchestras in some. There was a cultural educational division, Ilyich explains. There were actors there, musicians, and among them the camp artists. The camp had workshops for the prisoners to make things to use, sell, and barter. It had medical facilities with doctors or nurses. Prisoners were allowed contact with the outside world by mail. Many prisoners received monthly packages from their families containing food and tobacco. And many prisoners were released, when their sentences were served, back into Soviet society. Because the Soviet leadership and the camp's personnel, and even some prisoners, conceived of the Gulag as necessary to bring about the communist paradise, the guards often had a paradoxical attitude toward the prisoners. Vladimir Bukovsky, the Soviet dissident and prisoner, explains, "In our camps you were expected not only to be a slave laborer, but to sing and smile while you worked as well. They didn't just want to oppress us, they wanted us to thank them for it." And as time went on, they, like the Gulag itself, often softened up. All this was unthinkable for the German camps, which for most of its inhabitants were utterly and only places of damnation, torture, and death, which was exactly the Germans' intention. In many ways, the Gulag was a highly exacerbated eliminationist version or extension of Soviet society itself with all its pathologies. That is why people could enter the Gulag and then be released, and why free people could live nearby and have humane relations with the prisoners. The Germans, by contrast, created a camp world unto itself, inhabited by putative subhumans and demons, which was nothing like the life of the self-conceived master race. As in the Soviet Union, the communist Chinese had a range of institutions that functionally were camps, starting with their formal camp system, the Laogai, which they constructed upon taking power, and in which they incarcerated and put to work real and imagined enemies. As the Soviets had, the Chinese communists eliminated tens of millions by placing them in forced labor camps, so that at any given moment for at least two decades, each communist system housed in their camps more than 10 million people, who also suffered enormous mortality rates. From 1949 to 1953, when the Chinese communists were consolidating power and laying the groundwork for their vast country's social and economic transformation to communism, the regime killed on the order of 10 million people, mainly in their camps. The communists' transformative program's intensity reached two peaks during the Great Leap Forward from 1958 to 1961 and the Cultural Revolution from 1966 to 1976. The Great Leap Forward was intended to hasten the creation of the ideal economic order and powerhouse promised by Marxist theory. The Cultural Revolution was to bring about the ideological purity the communist transformative project required by purging society, especially the Communist Party itself, of those deemed impediments either ideologically or by deed. As is typical of vast camp systems, the regime and its perpetrators turned the prisoners into slaves, using them brutally for economic production, though typical for such systems, highly irrationally from an economic point of view. Once camp systems are created, perpetrators tend to expand and use them increasingly liberally, as they do with mass murder. Eliminationist institutions' existence, including camps, forecloses or makes other kinds of politics, from accommodation and compromise to conventional if brutal repression, less used, less practiced, less available, and less normative. Camps' existence alters the perpetrator's cost-benefit calculus, rendering the camp system's use and expansion ever more instrumentally rational compared to alternatives for perpetrators to act upon their hatreds, solve the perceived human, social, and political problems, and to consolidate and further their power. Still, these systems are not mindless omnivores. Anthropomorphizing accounts holding camp systems or the systems creating them as some sort of autonomous, hungry, and insatiable consumers of lives are not grounded in reality. Camp systems are measured tools of eliminationist political regimes bent upon refashioning or purifying societies according to thoroughgoing transformative visions. The Nazi German, the Imperial Japanese, the communist regimes of the Soviets, Chinese, North Koreans, and Khmer Rouge. The more we learn about camp systems, the clearer they systematically express their regimes and staff's ideological underpinnings. The perpetrators treat these systems' victims, those perishing and those suffering other horrible fates, according to their conceptions of the threats they and their country or ethnic group face, which is grounded in the particular character of their prejudices and hatreds, discussed momentarily. Camp systems afford perpetrators the constant opportunity to include new, real or imagined enemies in their eliminationist project, which changes as its implementation unfolds. It is striking how camp systems' expansions vary enormously from one eliminationist system to the next, in the range of victims, their functions, and their transformation's pace and size. The Nazis started with a few so-called wild camps, improvised detention places serving principally as chambers to torture their political enemies. Later, with public announcement and fanfare, they institutionalized these wild camps into a formal camp system, which quickly grew so that many tens of thousands passed through, though the regime released most of them. By 1939, the camp system had been reduced to 25,000 inmates. The Germans began expanding the camp population explosively only upon acquiring their empire and the opportunity to begin implementing their preconceived eliminationist and exterminationist projects. The Soviets established the Gulag's rudiments early on, systematically expanding it along with their destructive grip on Soviet society, mainly for putative domestic enemies. In the first phase, they incarcerated mainly the regime's real enemies, who had fought them or resisted their assumption and consolidation of power. In the 1930s, the camps became depositories for those seen as impediments to the Soviets' transformation of their country's agricultural and industrial systems. In the 1940s and 1950s, the camps gobbled up the victims of Stalin's growing paranoia. The Chinese communists created a colossal and fully mature camp system soon after taking power. The Americans' camp system for the Japanese, the most rationally organized and least brutal, had a specific warehousing purpose. It did not expand and was closed down when that purpose, ill-conceived and criminal as it was, became unnecessary upon Japan's defeat. The British camp system in Kenya grew in stages, in a manner unplanned and unforeseen, as their assault's intensity on the Kikuyu increased. That the Khmer Rouge sent most Cambodians on their way into camps within a few days of seizing power precluded the need to expand the system dramatically. Whatever particular camp system's trajectories, regimes establishing such systems are usually engaged in long processes of murderous domination or eschatological transformation, processes that the camp system's existence and availability further strengthen. The Soviets were trying to bring about the impossible, a modern, industrialized society based on a social theory, Marxism, denying a functioning modernity's certain fundamentals, free markets and free labor. When the millennial zeal died along with the paranoid tyrant Stalin, Khrushchev and those around him dismantled the camp system. The Germans, by contrast, were trying to bring about the possible, a European and eventually a world empire that, as Himmler and Franck indicated with their policy statements and instructions, and as ordinary German perpetrators understood, was to be a huge concentration camp organized according to racial biological domination, exploitation, and extermination principles. The Japanese were intent upon something similar in Asia. The Khmer Rouge succeeded in bringing about their idiosyncratic version of Marxist transformation because they sought not a modern, but a primitive totalitarian society wedded to a backward-looking nationalist agenda. Theirs was a workable, easily constructible model predicated on unfreedom, both economic and human. Seeking only to purify the Khmer people and enforce their ideological dictates, they made their camps into places of total atomization and pre-modern primitivism. Given the more limited aspirations of the Americans to warehouse Japanese Americans and the British to eliminate the Kikuyu's threat, the Americans succeeded partly because their aspirations were temporary, and the British succeeded only temporarily because, short of still vaster mass murder, their colonial racial domination, historically passé, was doomed. Understanding camp systems' overall purpose, character, and trajectory is only the larger part of their place as integral tools of eliminationist politics. The other part is their actual functioning. Except for the rare instances of single-purpose killing installations, such as the Germans' camps of Chełmno, Treblinka, and Sobibor on the one hand, and temporary warehousing, such as the Americans' camps for Japanese Americans on the other, camps and camp systems are internally complex institutions riven by contradictory purposes. They kill and create deadly conditions producing high, often mass murderous mortality rates. Yet they pursue ideological dictates, including punishment and some re-education, requiring victims to remain alive. They make varying attempts to be economically productive, yet according to any rational understanding of economic organization, they are thoroughly irrational. They intrinsically produce harsh, debilitating conditions for the inmates, because they are, as a rule, underfunded and undersupplied in every respect, especially food. Because they are economically unviable, an additional economic calculus victimizes their inmates. Why should scarce economic resources be allocated to these economic black holes, leading to an even greater undersupply of food and other things? Within camps themselves, regimes and their followers treat different prisoners differently. They immediately slaughter some, incarcerate others indefinitely, warehouse others temporarily. Camps are run by low-quality staff, often by people who, before coming to the camps, already dehumanized or demonized victims. Day-to-day, camps and their personnel often operate relatively autonomously from the regime, aside from its broad ideological dictates, governed less by rules and more by personalistic and arbitrary whim. The perpetrators' staffing camps exercise virtually unrestrained power over victims, inherently producing great abuses. In light of these features, it is no wonder that camp worlds, while coherent as general places of elimination, domination, and destruction, are incoherent in their actual running, including the multiple ways that camps' various aspects systematically conflict. The most obvious and acute contradictions are camps' destructive and productive uses. Perpetrators employ many camp systems or individual camps as vehicles of death, often through massive expected or calculated attrition owing to the inhuman conditions and treatment. Almost all camp systems also compel their victims to work, seeking to produce some economic value. Yet, at most, victims' work defrays a usually small portion of the huge economic loss of resting productive workers from the normal economy, which also is not always governed by rational economic principles. Putting the victims to work is but a natural corollary of the eliminationist project, and what every eliminationist project is at heart, a massive, economically destructive initiative. American Ambassador Henry Morgenthau appealed to economic rationality to deter Mehmet Talat from completing his exterminationist program against the Armenians. "If you are not influenced by humane considerations," Morgenthau reasoned, "think of the material loss. These people are your businessmen. They control many of your industries. They are very large taxpayers. What would become of you commercially without them?" Talat replied that they had already calculated all this and that it didn't matter. "We care nothing about the commercial loss." Without disputing Morgenthau's warning that in killing the Armenians they were ruining the country economically, or in the words of American Consul Leslie Davis, "by one stroke the country was to be set back a century," Ismail Enver reiterated this point, definitively declaring that economic considerations are of no importance at this time. The Germans similarly did not care that by destroying the Jews they enormously damaged their economy and even their chances of winning the war. So economically irrational was their ideologically driven treatment of the Jews that, in the face of a massive labor shortage of more than 2.5 million workers, according to their own report about the part of occupied Poland called the General Government, they employed full-time only 450,000 out of 1.4 million Jewish workers. The rest, totaling almost 1 million, were employed for a short period. Of course, under their total annihilation program, the Germans killed almost all these Jewish workers in the next months anyway. This accorded exactly with the German leadership's understanding of their exterminationist priorities' colossal economic destructiveness. Reinhard Heydrich explained at the Wannsee Conference, "The Jews will be conscripted for labor, and undoubtedly a large number of them will drop out through natural wastage. The rest they would kill." Such was the relationship between annihilation and work, the annihilation's primacy, and how an eliminationist program is the sine qua non for the creation of the derivative phenomenon of camps. The Soviet Gulag is the camp system most clearly intended for something approximating rational economic exploitation, with production goals assigned to the camps and, by individual camp administrations, to the individual inmates. Moreover, the Gulag's administration and the Soviet regime devoted considerable energy to using the camps economically and more productively. Yet the Gulag could not overcome its many contradictions inhibiting production, including its fundamental non-economic eliminationist reason for being. This made it utterly irrational economically, unprofitable, and far less productive than free labor, as the Soviet regime's members themselves knew from the beginning. The regime's own records demonstrate this as early as July 1919 and in the 1920s. In 1938, in response to the camp's massive production shortfalls, the Communist Party leaders responsible for the Gulag held candid meetings about their ongoing economic catastrophe. "Chaos and disorder, Our camps are organized unsystematically, a particularly difficult situation with food supplies, which led to an enormous percentage of weak workers, an enormous percentage of prisoners who couldn't work at all, and a high death rate and illness rate, were among their many withering economic criticisms. This continued throughout. 15 years later, in 1953, an inspection the Communist Party's Central Committee ordered determined that camps were enormously unprofitable, costing more to maintain than their laborers produced. Not only did camp labor not produce more than the general economy's labor, but it was negatively productive, running a deficit, soaking up badly needed capital from genuine economic enterprises in a capital-starved economy. The official Guatemalan Commission for Historical Clarification, established with the mandate to investigate and report on the Guatemalan government's eliminationist assault upon leftists and Maya, calculated that in the 10-year period from 1980 to 1989 alone, the total direct quantifiable costs were equivalent to zero production in Guatemala for almost 15 months, equal to 121% of the 1990 gross domestic product, GDP. That is an astonishing amount of economic loss. Moreover, the total losses were considerably greater because the eliminationist onslaught and destruction lasted many more years, and this calculation included only five of the seven most destructive years, 1978 through 1985. The report further detailed the losses. The majority of costs, equivalent to 90% of the 1990 GDP, resulted from the loss of production potential due to the death, disappearance, or forced displacement of individuals who had to abandon their daily activities, or from recruitment into the PAC, the army, or the guerrillas. The destruction of physical assets, including private and community property, and the loss of infrastructure, such as bridges and electrical towers, also represented considerable losses, over 6% of the 1990 GDP. These material losses frequently involved the total destruction of family capital, especially among Mayan families, particularly in the west and northwest of Guatemala. Exterminationist and eliminationist assaults are economically utterly irrational. The Guatemalan assault highlights the critical issue. The economic loss owing to just the lost productivity of the victims was 90% of the overall economic loss, which was equivalent to shutting down the country's entire economy for a year and a quarter. Had the Guatemalan perpetrators, instead of slaughtering and driving Maya from the country, deposited them in camps, grossly underfed them, subjected them to most camp systems' brutal work and living conditions, producing extremely high mortality rates, and then worked them as slaves in irrationally organized and outfitted sites, the lost economic productivity, perhaps somewhat less, would still have been catastrophic. It is simply bizarre to think that such standard camp conditions are a recipe for greater economic output than what the Guatemalan economy lost owing to the regime's elimination of Maya, or for that matter, than what any other economy lost with its eliminationist program. Soviet camp commanders, particularly interested in economic production, recognized this and therefore chose to undermine the Gulag's ordinary regimen. One commander, according to former prisoner Alexei Priatilov, ran the camp like an economic organization and behaved toward prisoners not as if they were criminals or enemies whom it was necessary to re-educate, but as though they were workers. Why? He was convinced that there was no point in trying to get good work out of hungry people. None of this is surprising, as perpetrators do not create camp systems for economic purposes. The notion that they do is ideological nonsense, serving the perpetrators' wish to conceal their real motives and purposes, as well as their many interpreters' and apologists' desires to justify the perpetrators' actions, deflect attention from the truth, or ideologically indict a political-economic dispensation. Economic rationality was manifestly not the core conception of regimes, the Germans in Southwest Africa, Soviets, Nazis, Croatians, Chinese, Americans, North Koreans, the British in Kenya, Indonesians, Ethiopians, Khmer Rouge, Serbs, and many others in creating camps to eliminate real or imagined enemies. This aside, only camps' ideologized supporters or people sympathetic to the camps' irrational underpinnings can believe that plunging people into inhuman, debilitating conditions and turning productive workers with differentiated skills into weakened and sick slaves laboring at unfamiliar tasks often below their skill levels is a program for rational economic organization and high productivity. Any idea that a regime's economic need brings people into camps, even in camp systems' most rationally organized part, misconstrues the causal relationship. The perpetrator's ideological worldview brings camps into being, sustains them, and engenders their image of humanity and society that first creates victims and then mobilizes them as irrationally used workers. The Khmer Rouge turned a country self-sufficient in foodstuffs, rice being the agricultural staple, into an agricultural and economic disaster, so naturally they worked people in the communes growing rice. Ratha Duong, a pen name, then a child, conveys this as well as her clear understanding that she was, and was to be, a victim of one of the Khmer Rouge's many interchangeable eliminationist means, of which enslavement was one. In November and early December 1976, there was no food to eat. I was sick. I asked myself when I was going to die. Would I die by starvation or by torture? I thought that if I died, I would no longer have to work like an animal. I asked my group leader for permission to rest one day. She said no. So I worked in the field planting rice. My legs were weak from standing in the mud. The rain fell hard and my body shook with chills. My eyes couldn't see. I felt dizzy and then I collapsed in the mud. I heard the group leader tell girls to carry me out under the tree. I was unconscious. Virtually everything the Khmer Rouge had people do and how they had them live, including how they prepared the young for adult life, violated any notion of economic rationality. One 11-year-old boy describes how the Khmer Rouge reared him and other teenage boys, having, as they had with most children in Cambodia, separated them from their families. The boys were not taught to read or write or to sing any songs. We were never shown any radios, books, or magazines. Instead, they were compelled to build a road that was supposed to cross hundreds of kilometers of uninhabited forest. How did these workers do it? We all worked at the rate of 2 or 3 meters of road per day, using locally made buckets to shift the earth. Some boys threw up the soil while others packed it down into a road surface. By the time I left this site 5 months later, no vehicles had yet been seen on the road. At that rate, these young boys would have taken a year to complete just 1 kilometer. The Khmer Rouge's worldview, producing Cambodia's total economic catastrophe, was but the extreme variant of our age's economically irrational and self-destructive ideologies creating camps and governing their work.